Let's continue the Night Circus by Erin Morgenstern. Stratagem, London, April 1886. She's too good to keep out in the crowd, Chandra says. She simply must have her own tent. We'll put the seats in a ring or something. Keep the audience right in the middle of the action. Yes, sir, Marco says, fiddling with his notebook, running his fingers over the pages that have been wings only minutes before. Whatever is the matter with you, Chandra asks. You're as white as a sheet. His voice echoes through the empty theater as they stand alone on the stage, Madame Padva having whisked Miss Bowen off, peppering her with questions about gowns and hairstyles. I'm fine, sir, Marco says. You look awful, Chandra says, puffing his cigar. Go home. Marco looks up at him, surprised. Sir, there's paperwork that needs to be done, he protests. Do it tomorrow, plenty of time for such things. Padma and I will take Miss Bowen back to the house for tea, and we can sort out the particulars and paperwork later. Get some rest, or have a drink, or whatever it is you do. Chandra waves a hand at him absently, the smoke from his cigar trailing in bobbing waves. If you insist, sir, I do insist, and get rid of the rest of those fellows in the lobby. No need to see a bunch of suits with capes when we've already found something far more interesting. Quite attractive, too, I should think. Indeed, sir, Marco says, a blush creeping into his pallor. Until tomorrow, then. He nods his head in something almost like a bow before turning gracefully on his heels and heading to the lobby. Didn't take you to be the easily spooked type, Marco. Chandra calls after him, but Marco does not turn. Marco politely dismisses the illusionists in the lobby, explaining the position has been filled and thanking them for their time. None of them notice that his hands are shaking or that he is clutching the pen in his hand so tightly that his knuckles are white, nor do they notice when it snaps in two within his fist, black ink seeping down his wrist. After the illusionists have departed, Marco gathers his things, wiping his ink-covered hand on his black coat. He puts on his bowler hat before he exits the theater. With every step, he grows more visibly distressed. People move out of his way on the crowded pavement. When he reaches the flat, Marco drops his bag to the floor, leaning against the door with a heavy sigh. What's wrong? Isabel asks from a chair next to the empty fireplace. She conceals the length of hair she had been braiding in her pocket, scowling as she knows she will have to rebraid the entire piece because her concentration was broken. It is the part she still has the most difficulty with, the concentration and focus. For now, she abandons it and watches Marco as he crosses the room to reach the bookcases lining the wall. I know who my opponent is, Marco says, pulling armfuls of books down from their shelves and spreading them out haphazardly over tables, leaving several in messy piles on the floor. Those remaining on the shelves collapse, a few volumes falling, but Marco does not seem to notice. Is it the Japanese woman who you were curious about? Isabella asks, watching as Marco's impeccable filing system falls into chaos. The flat has always been kept in perfect order, and she finds the sudden upheaval disquieting. No, Marco says, as he flips through pages, it's Prospero's daughter. Isabel picks up a potted violet that had toppled in the wake of the falling books and places it back onto its shelf. Prospero, she asks, the magician, the one you saw in Paris? Marco nods. I didn't know he had a daughter, she says. I was unaware of that fact myself, Marco says, discarding one book and picking up another. Chandris just hired her to be the illusionist for the circus. Really? Isabel asks. Marco does not respond. So she'll be doing what you said he did. Actual magic disguised as stage illusions. Did she do that at the audition? Yes, she did, Marco says, without looking up from his books. She must be very good. She's too good, Marco says, pulling another shelf worth of books from their resting place and moving them to the table, the violet, an innocent victim once more. This could be extremely problematic, he says, almost to himself. A pile of notebooks slip from the table to the floor in a flurry of fluttering pages and a sound like the wings of birds, Isabel retrieving the violet again, placing it across the room. Does she know who you are? She asks. I do not believe so, Marco says. Does that mean the circus is part of the challenge? Isabel asks. Marco stops flipping through pages and looks up at her. It must, he says before he returns his attention to the book. That's likely why I was sent to work for Chandra, so I would already be involved. The circus is the venue. Is that good? Isabel asks when Marco does not answer. Lost in the flood of paper and ink again, with one hand he fidgets with the cloth of the other sleeve. A splatter of black ink stains the white cuff. She changed the fabric, he muttered to himself. How did she change the fabric? Isabel moves a pile of abandoned books to the desk where her deck rests. She looks up at Marco, who is now deeply engrossed in a particular volume. She quietly spreads the cards out in a long line across the desk. Keeping her eyes on Marco, she draws a single card. She flips it over on the desk and looks down to see what her cards have to say about the matter. A man stands between two women, a cherub like bow and arrow hovering over their heads. The lovers. Is she pretty? Isabel asks. Marco does not answer. She pulls another card and lays it on top. She frowns at the picture of the crumbling tower and the falling figure. She returns both cards to the deck, pushing it back into an orderly stack. Is she stronger than you? Isabel asks. Again, Marco fails to answer, flipping through the pages of the notebook. For years, he has felt reasonably well prepared. Practicing with Isabel has provided an advantage, enabling him to improve aspects of his illusions to the point where even with her familiarity, she cannot always discern what is real. But faced with his opponent, his feeling about the challenge has suddenly changed, replaced by nerves and confusion. He had half expected he would simply know what to do when the time came. When he had entertained the thought that the time might never come, that the promise of the game was something to motivate his studies and nothing more. So the competition will begin when the circus opens, then, Isabel asks him. He had almost forgotten she was there. I suppose that would be logical, Marco says. I don't understand how we are meant to compete when the circus is going to travel and I must remain in London. I shall have to do everything remotely. I could go, Isabel says. What? Marco asks, looking up at her again. You said the circus still needs a fortune teller, didn't you? I could read my cards. I haven't read for anyone but myself, but I am getting better at it. I could write you letters when the circus is away. It would give me some place to go if you're not supposed to have me here while you play your game. I'm not sure that's a good idea, Marco says, though he cannot articulate why. He had never considered the possibility of involving Isabel in his life outside the bounds of this flat. He had been keeping her separate from Chandra's and the circus, both to have something of his own and because it seemed appropriate, especially given his instructor's vague advice about the matter. Please, Isabel asks. This way I can help you. Marco hesitates, glancing down at his book. His thoughts remain preoccupied with the image of the girl from the theater. It will help you to be closer to the circus, Isabel continues, and it will give me something to do for the duration of your challenge when it's done, I can come back to London. I'm not even certain how the challenge is going to work, Marco says. But you're certain that I can't stay here during it, she asks. Marco sighs. They had discussed it before, but not in any great detail, but enough to establish that when the game began, she would have to leave. I am already so busy working for Chandra's, and I will need to focus on the competition without distraction, he says, using his instructor's choice of word. From an order disguised as a suggestion. He is not certain which option bothers him more, involving Isabel in the game or relinquishing the one relationship in his life that has not been dictated for him. This way I wouldn't be a distraction. I'd be helping, Isabel says. And if you're not supposed to have help, well, I'll only be writing you letters. What's wrong with that? It seems like a perfect solution to me. I could arrange for you to meet with Chandra's, Marco suggests. You could? Convince him to hire me? Couldn't you? Isabel asks, if he needs convincing. Marco nods, still not entirely certain about the idea, but almost desperate for some kind of strategy, a tactic to use in dealing with his newly revealed opponent. He turns her name over and over in his mind. What is Prospero's daughter named? Isabel asks as she can tell what he's thinking. Bowen, Marco says. Her name is Celia Bowen. It's a pretty name, Isabel says. Is something wrong with your hand? Marco looks down, surprised to find that he has been holding his right hand and his left, unconsciously stroking the empty space where a ring was once burned into his skin. No, he says, picking up a notebook to occupy his hand. It's nothing. Isabel seems satisfied with the response, lifting a pile of fallen books from the floor and stacking them on the desk. Marco is relieved that she does not have the skill to pull the memory of the ring from his mind. Fire and light. You step into a bright, open courtyard surrounded by striped tents. Curving pathways along the perimeter lead away from the courtyard, turning into unseen mysteries dotted with twinkling lights. There are vendors traversing the crowd around you, selling refreshments and oddities, creations flavored with vanilla and honey, chocolate and cinnamon. A contortionist is in a sparkling black costume twists on a platform nearby, bending her body into impossible shapes. A juggler tosses globes of black and white and silver high into the air where they seem to hover before falling again into his hands, his attentive spectators applauding, all bathed in glowing light. The light emanates from a large bonfire in the center of the courtyard. As you walk closer, you can see that it sits in a wide black iron cauldron, balanced on a number of clawed feet, where the rim of the cauldron would be. It breaks into long strips of curled iron, as though it had been melted and pulled apart like taffy. The curling iron continues up until it curls back into itself, weaving in and out amongst the other curls, giving it a cage-like effect. The flames are visible in the gaps between the rising slightly above. They are obscured only at the bottom, so it is impossible to tell what is burning, if it is wood or coal or something else entirely. The flames are not yellow or orange, but white as snow as they dance.